30 people. And we got all the time because I don't want to go late because I'll interfere with my next class. It's the first time in years I'm like stuck in the same room all day long. All right.
So we did the video. Apologize for getting it out. I think I got it up during class time, but I did send a message early in the morning. Just let you know that that wasn't gonna come in. Normally I'm not scared of ice or snow or all the rest, but as I was getting ready to go out, actually it was a car accident right in front of my house and the road was blocked. So when I saw that, I'm just like, yeah, I'm not gonna bother. So I went up and I started doing the video, and I would have gotten your video done quicker, but as I started doing it, I'm like, you know, I didn't like it. So everything that was on the video that I recorded, I did that all like 2 hours before I actually recorded. I just like took throughout the old and I just rebuilt it all. And it made sense. I shot off the video, honest to God, I was patting myself on the back like, way to go, Womatic. That actually made sense compared to what I used to do. So. But essentially, we're dealing with Japan at a time when Japan was a mess. It's hard for any of us to imagine what that would be like, because we happen to live in a government, with the exception of a few odd years in the 1860s, for the most part, have managed to figure out our problems, and we haven't had a complete political, social breakdown of society akin to what took place in Japan. But despite the decades and decades and centuries of chaos, by the 16th century, there were many people in Japan that began trying to make a move to bring the nation back together again. So instead of it being decentralized and fragmented into those mini little fiefs, but instead to restore a single political state. But it would not be possible in the lifetime of one man. And as it turns out, it would take three men to do it. And if any of you have Netflix, there is a docu-series, I think it's called Samurai, I don't remember, that actually deals with this, and it does go a little deeper into these three men that I'm going to. Just, we don't have time to do it like they did, but if you're into this stuff, definitely worth watching. And another thing that's also really good was, it came out on FX last year, Shogun. That is based on these events, even though they don't use the names, the actual men and women that were involved. But that does a really good, particularly if you start watching the first two episodes, when Blackthorn, or whatever his name was, gets culture shock as to what life was like in Japan. When you, like, for instance, just had the samurai walking down the road and someone got in his way and you just cut his head off. That's what life was like then. But so if you want a good snapshot, that's something else I recommend. Because again, it's completely foreign to our society. But anyways, the first of the three men to push Japan towards reunification was Oda Nobunaga. Now, Nobunaga was from a warrior clan, but his clan was a minor household. So based on what I covered in the video, that means he and his father, his brothers, his cousins, they had the right to basically hold themselves as samurai if they could earn that position. But because they were a minor household, that meant they worked for some of the bigger clans. But it was during his young life where he would quickly display natural skills of leadership that would allow him to go from somebody on the bottom rungs of the ladder to the highest points. He was unique in the way that he approached war. One of the things I did mention is that war was changing. So unlike some of the other war leaders who believe that only, you know, the military clans should be the ones fighting and battles should involve battles between samurai, Nobunaga didn't care. If you were a guy and you had a pulse, Two arms, two legs, you could be used for warring. He was daring. He was brave. He did not follow tradition. Instead, he was always willing to innovate. And he engaged in ruthless determination to the point of being cruel. Because to be honest with you, if you're going to go to war with somebody, you can't sit there and play patty cakes with them. If you're going to go to war, the only purpose of war is to kill them all, to win. He also was not afraid to disregard the rules of Bushido. He would engage in surprise attacks, stealth maneuvers, and assassinations. But one of the most extraordinary things that he did can actually be depicted on this drawing. He was one of the first war leaders in Japan to utilize the firearms that the Portuguese merchants had brought to shore. Now, guns had been present for a couple of decades, but he ordered his blacksmiths to basically take the Portuguese weapons apart, strip it all the way down, and basically copy it. That would allow him to mass produce arms. Because he realized it takes a lifetime to master the samurai techniques with the swords and the other weapons. But any fool can learn how to use a gun in a few minutes. It's not that hard. Load it up, aim it away from you, pull the trigger. So this allowed him to build large armies cheaply that were lethal. Now granted, the muskets that they used were not accurate by any means, and they were not reliable. But whenever I think of the clash between a gun and a sword, I'm reminded of that scene in Indiana Jones. You know, the Raiders of the Lost Ark, when they're in the middle, and the guy comes out and he's like, big guy with the sword, and he's like, pow. Gun bullets win. But, in the code of Bushido, firearms could be regarded as dishonorable because you don't come eye to eye with your enemy. You don't feel the warmth of their blood as it spurts on you. You kill someone from the other side of the parking lot. But in Nobunaga's mind, it's about the win. It's about the W. He also was fascinated by Westerns. He wasn't scared of new things. In fact, he did something that no other Japanese did. He allowed his image to be sketched by a Portuguese monk. That is the closest thing you can get to a picture of Oda Nobunaga. That is him. Why did he allow the Jesuits to do it? Why did he welcome the missionaries into his fief? New ideas, new technologies. And if you're going to win, you need to embrace new ideas, new technologies. And he knew that these priests were the ones who were going to give it to him. Now, ironically, Nobunaga also allowed the priests to establish churches in his domain. So it's in his fiefdom where Christianity was first basically implanted in Japan. So, long story short, beginning in the 1550s, going all the way up until the 1570s, he engaged in clashes and battles, always walking away victorious. So much so that by 1573, he had built enough strength and enough alliances, he would actually topple the shogunate. Oh, wait, no. There we go. He was the one who deposed the last of the Ashikaga shoguns. Because what was the point of having a shogun, this military ruler of Japan, when they in fact had no control over anybody? Once he toppled the Ashikaga, he then launched a campaign aimed at conquering the big island of Honshu. By 1580, I don't know if you can see the angle, but all of this in the purple came under his control. Some of the daimyos he defeated. Some of the daimyos he made alliances with. But he could basically count on the authority and influence over the bulk of the Japanese home island. Once he secured Honshu, he then planned on going south. Because down here in the orange were two powerful clans, the Satsuma and the Choshu. Well, obviously he had an alliance that controlled most of the state. He knew he needed to defeat these two in order to claim the right, potentially, of becoming the next shogun. But he was betrayed. One of his vassal generals hired a group of assassins to take out Nobunaga. While he was praying in a temple. Now, Nobunaga knew that the temple was surrounded, and again, it depicts it in that Netflix series. He knew that he basically couldn't get out, but he stayed inside, and he basically killed everybody that came in to get him. Knowing his lethality, what they then decided to do was lock the doors and they set the temple on fire. So it was only a matter of time, probably, before he was knocked out from the fumes, and as either his body was incinerated or the building collapsed.
What is behind that picture?
What?
Or the second to last bullet point that I moved.
Oh, move Daimyo. Western Daimyo. So, he's there, he's rolling, he's on the verge, and then he's betrayed by one of his underlings. And at quick glance, it appeared that the effort to bring Japan under the control of one had been undone. But one of his top generals would rise in the footsteps of his master, Toyotomi Hideyoshi. Hideyoshi acted quickly. He would betray, or rather kill, those who betrayed Nobunaga. Once the traitors were dealt with, he then took Nobunaga's army and marched on the southern clans, the western clans, and basically subdued them. And by 1590, he was the last man standing. But unlike Oda Nobunaga, Toyotomi Hideyoshi was the beneficiary of Nobunaga's willingness to use peasant soldiers. Hideyoshi was born a peasant. He was basically recruited into the army because he had two hands, two arms, two legs, etc. But shortly after engaging in battle, Nobunaga saw his prowess and promoted him all the way up to the rank of general. And it's his abilities that would allow him to basically conquer Japan. But while he was effective on the battlefield, Hideyoshi was also a master of diplomacy. Whereas Nobunaga was like a club, Hideyoshi was like a fine scalpel. He realized you didn't need to bludgeon people into place, but you could have conversations, you could have dialogue, and you could find common ground. So, he didn't need to conquer all of Japan. He managed to hold together Nobunaga's alliance by basically making deals with all of the powerful daimyo. In Shogun, he is regarded as the, what do they call him, Toyomi or something like that? The big war leader that had died, and you can see his suit of armor referenced. Now, by the way, one other quick side note before I go forward. He, if you were Japanese and you went to school in Japan today, he's regarded as their George Washington. Because it's thanks to Hideyoshi that Japan was reunited, and they kind of mark his rise as the beginning of the modern age. All right. Coming up, crushed all resistance. All right, there we go. Now, once he conquered all, his full mastery went on full effect. Because even though he was not of a high noble clan, he understood the need to implement a government that actually worked. So he would establish a foundation that would allow him, of common stock, to essentially rule over the nation. And this foundation, like I said, would be in place for the next 300 years. What he did was reform the feudal system that I talked about. Under the Japanese system, if you recall, if you watched the video, Japan was decentralized. It was the emperor, but the emperor was the figurehead. He technically was God's agent on earth. In charge of the day-to-day affairs of state was the shogun. But Japan itself was divided into those fiefs. And in those fiefs, the daimyo were like kings. Some of them, which is one of the reasons why the war of all against all occurred, basically continued to do their own thing and constantly wage war on the neighbors. So there was no control. But technically, those daimyo didn't have legal right to possess the land. So what does Hideyoshi do? He brings all of the daimyo together and essentially gets them to bend the knee. And he made them all his vassals. So, kind of like what happened in Europe. They would bend down. The siege lord would basically knight them and would give them some type of token of their land. Basically, Hideyoshi gave land to those daimyo who were loyal to him. And he said, you rule over it in my name. The best states, the best fiefs, went to his most trusted allies, which ensured they would remain loyal to him. But if you betrayed him, he'd pull your title. He'd take your land and he'd give it to somebody else. He also, which is ironic because he was a peasant,
he also barred anyone else
from going up in rank, socially speaking.
If you were born a noble house, you stayed a noble house. If you were born common stock, you would stay a common stock. He wasn't going to reward or award anyone with titles of nobility.
And he also passed a law that said you were only allowed to marry people in your class. So if you came from one of the high noble families, you could only marry someone from a high noble family. If you came from one of the military clans, you were only allowed to marry somebody from a military clan. If you were a commoner, you're marrying a commoner.
Why? Conformity. Stability. Continuity.
If you constantly have people that potentially could go up, that means someone's going to fall down. And that's going to ensure chaos.
What if he didn't like it? Well, too bad. He also disarmed the population. Launching what became known as the Great Sword Hunt.
Hideyoshi outlawed the possession of weapons by peasants, commoners. Only those who were born to a military clan had the right to keep and bear arms.
Which essentially meant that 5% of the population could control 90%.
I'm watching it again. That's the only reason why I know it's in my mind. First episode of Shogun. 15 minutes in. Samurai's walking down the street.
A peasant comes out, accidentally trips. Cuts his head off. And then just marches on. Well, all the people are like, ah! By the way, not meaning to be political, but that's the reason why those people who want to have political power in our country and control every action we do constantly talk about the need to have gun bans or smart gun laws.
Because they want to disarm the people. Because if you can disarm the people, you control the people. But as extraordinary as these three points were, what really makes Hideyoshi atypical is his reaction to the European entry into the Asian trade network.
By the 1580s and 90s, the Portuguese already have their bases of operation. The Spanish already have a hold on the Philippines.
The English are slowly coming in. The Dutch are slowly coming in.
And word is spreading of what these people are doing. They're trying to take control of the flow of trade. In Hideyoshi's mind, an invasion was inevitable.
So, the best way to prevent an invasion by the Europeans is to create a buffer by conquering nearby land masses.
He would launch, by the way, he dreamed of conquering the Philippines, he dreamed of conquering China, he dreamed of even conquering India and Indonesia.
He basically foresaw a point when the Japanese would control all of the Pacific.
The first target was Korea. Because if you look at a map, Korea is only like 100 miles away from the heartland of Japan. It's like a dagger to the heart of Japan. So, and by the way, it's Korea when Kublai Khan
actually attempted to cross the Sea of Japan and invade Japan from. Hideyoshi knew his history. So what does he decide to do? He decides to invade Korea. Conquer it!
Two invasions, collectively known as the Imjin Wars, but neither were successful. Korea proved to be a quagmire. And in the end, he failed.
But they were huge. Again, if you want to change your topic, the Imjin War is fascinating. He sailed across the Sea of Japan with something like 150,000 samurai warriors.
It must have been epic. But in the end, he would fall ill during the second invasion and would eventually die.
Exposing the biggest flaw to his system. We can call this almost like hubris. You know, if you reach the highest levels and you think you're going to be in power forever, I hate to break it to you, you're going to die. So plan for it.
And he did not.
So, when he fell ill, he attempted to convince his vassals to basically pave the way for hereditary title. So that way his son, who was like 5 years old, could basically have a council of regents and control things until his son reached the age of ascent. But once Hideyoshi was dead, it would only be a matter of time before the regents began offing each other. Because Hideyoshi was not of noble blood.
But one of the men tasked
to be on the Council of Regents, who was a warrior leader in Nobunaga's army, and remained close friends with Hideyoshi,
Tokugawa Ieyasu. It would be Ieyasu who would basically complete the job that Hideyoshi almost finished.
But, unlike his friend, he was not focused on imperialism. He thought that Hideyoshi's overseas campaigns were wasteful. So instead, he focused on consolidating his authority at home. Now, as it was kind of playing out in Shogun, because again, the Shogun is based on this, what really happened, there would be five daimyo who would serve as the regents for Hideyoshi's son. But one of the five died, bringing it down to four. The moment that occurred, the three remaining decided to off Ieyasu. So they launched a campaign that would last 3 years. Thousands and thousands of Japanese died in this conflict.
Excuse me.
Thank you. But in the end, Ieyasu won. He built enough alliances that allowed him to defeat the what you would think was an imbalance. I mean, if you have three powerful warlords with their vassals and their armies going against one, you would think three would win.
But he used all of the skills of his predecessors. Innovation, deception, whatever it took to achieve victory. And in the end, he beat everyone. When that occurred, he was summoned by the emperor.
And in 1603, the emperor saw fit to grant Tokugawa Ieyasu the title of shogun. Because, unlike Nobunaga, who came from a minor military clan, unlike Hideyoshi, who was a commoner, Tokugawa Ieyasu's clan was an offshoot of the Minamoto, which was the closest clan to the royal house. So he didn't have a claim on the throne, but he was like third cousins with the emperor. So because he had high blood, he was deemed worthy of this high position. Once entrusted with the shogunate, Ieyasu studied history and saw what happened to the last two shogunates, the Kamakura shogunate, the Ashikaga shogunate. Both became weak, lax, corrupt, and in the end they lost power. So Ieyasu was determined not to have that happen again. So what does he do? Well, he takes the remaining daimyo and moves them around, just like Hideyoshi did. But he did so to make a permanent entrenched defensive system. From his base in Edo, the modern city of Tokyo, he selected all of his direct vassals, the people that were directly linked to his house, either through blood or through agreements. And he stationed them all throughout the vast plain region of Japan. Because if you are one of the enemy clans, to get to the capital, you would have to fight to all of his relatives and his allies. He then removed some daimyo from financially significant areas. These are shown in the pink. With his capital in Edo, the last thing he wanted to do is, you know, have the bad guys, the Mito, you know, holding those lands. So he removed them, and he basically controlled them like vassals. All the rest of the daimyo was scattered in the farthest corners of Japan. And the enemies were put really far away. Again, on the simple notion that if you wanted to go to war with them, you had to travel through all of this country to get to them. But I'm not done. You keep your friends close, and you keep your enemies closer. He sentenced his enemies to the far reaches, but to make sure that they wouldn't engage in any scheming, any type of chicanery, shenanigans, he ordered that every single daimyo, friend and foe, had to live in the capital under his protection. So, all of the daimyo, they had castles, inside his capital city. They were not allowed to use their own guards. You used his soldiers as guards. You were not allowed to enter the city with your weapons, even the daimyo. You had to be disarmed. And, for 6 months out of the year, you would be allowed to go home. You want to make sure that your fief is running. But when you left, your wife and your children stayed in Edo. So you're contemplating rebellion? There goes your family.
questions. So,
once Japan was unified, once it was stabilized, everything seemed to be going right in the right direction, except for the fact that the Europeans were taking advantage of the chaos of the war of all against all. Going back to the arrival of the first group, 1543, when a group of shipwrecked Portuguese crashed up against the rocky shoreline and were basically taken prisoner by the Japanese. The moment the first ship came, it would be only a matter of time before others came. Traders, merchants, missionaries, boat by boat.
Now, some of the Japanese daimyo would kill the Europeans on sight. But others, like Nobunaga, were curious. What do you have to offer? And one of the things that they had was like when we talked about with the Portuguese trade system. They had established control over some of the trade routes. So the bulk of what they brought with them were the Asian goods.
Be it the spices, or the silks, the lacquerware.
And they exchanged them for Japanese goods. Pottery, copper, wood,
even some silver.
The Portuguese also brought some Western goods. Guns, printing presses, clocks, and other novelties. So, Japan was open. But coming with the merchants were the priests.
And the priests began attempting to convert the Japanese people. Now, as I said, some daimyo were okay with this. Nobunaga, for example, he was curious about this Christian religion. And he saw it as a possible counter to militant Buddhism, which I didn't talk about in the video. I didn't really feel like going down that rabbit hole. It's really long and complicated. But just to make it simple, by the 16th century, there were a few Buddhist monasteries where the monks were warriors.
So Nobunaga thought, well, we could use the Christians as leverage against the Buddhist daimyo.
Some were protected, allowed to preach. Like I said, Nobunaga allowed a church to be built in his fiefdom.
And in some domains, the Jesuits were able to convert the daimyo.
In the moment the daimyo converted to Christianity, it seems that it was kind of like top-down conversion.
But while hundreds of thousands of Japanese would convert, Nobunaga never did. When Nobunaga was killed,
Hideyoshi looked at the situation. Now, while he wasn't openly hostile, he wasn't necessarily a big fan.
One of the biggest problems that Hideyoshi had with Christianity was there were reports that some of the soldiers who had converted refused to obey orders.
particularly if it went against the rules of the faith. You know, true Christians will not go into a village and kill every man, woman, and child in the village and then burn it to the ground. So apparently there were some samurai that disobeyed orders, which of course was troubling to Hideyoshi. Plus, one of the reasons why he did the imperialism, he was concerned that these Europeans would come in. So it's possible that these Jesuits was the first wave of an invasion. So we have to watch them.
But by the time of Tokugawa Ieyasu,
he was outright hostile. There was a movie that was made, and I don't know what streaming platform it's on. It might be Netflix. It has Adam Driver in it. It has Andrew Garfield. There's one of the big names in there, and I can't remember his name. He was Qui-Gon Jinn in Star Wars.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he also did like Taken, and those like, what? Liam Neeson. Yep, he was in it.
It actually tells the story of what was going on in Japan upon Ieyasu's rise.
Ieyasu basically decided to persecute Christians and eradicate from the home islands. He ordered hunts where his retainers would go out village to village and root out who were the Christians.
And in the movie Silence, they do a good job using historically accurate tactics that the Japanese would actually use. One of the easiest way to tell who was a Christian and who wasn't was to take a crucifix, put it on the ground, and order them to step on it. If you are a true Christian and you believe that Jesus is the Son of God, you would never, ever do that. So the moment the Japanese commoner or peasant did one of these, they were discovered and they would be dealt with.
And in Silence, they showed one of the most brutal ways that they dealt with them. They would tie him to a cross, crucify him, but put the cross
into the seabed when it was low tide, and allow them to sit there when the tide came in, pulverizing their body
with every single oncoming thrust of the waves.
The point that they got. Oh, look up in the top. Oh, look at all those people getting crucified. They also buried them up to the neck and rode horses over them. Sometimes they just outright killed them with their sword, beheaded them. You know, brutal. They looked for Bibles, burned them. They looked for crucifixes, burned them.
And then once it spread across the land, they began looking in all of the trade goods that were brought in to see if Bibles and crucifixes were being smuggled.
And ultimately, it would be this drive to wipe out Christianity
that would convince the Tokugawa to attempt to erase Japan from the world's map. Beginning during the reign of Ieyasu, in continuing onward through his son, the first two shoguns after Ieyasu were two of his sons. Bit by bit, they began closing Japan down. It first began in 1616, when the shogun basically announced that Westerners were only allowed to go to a few isolated ports. then, shortly after that, all Japanese were forbidden to sail overseas. If you were born in Japan, you had to stay in Japan. Then they began basically banning certain European nations. They hated the Spanish because the Spanish, you know, brought the conquistadors and the Jesuits, so we're not going to have them.
By the 1660s, the Portuguese had collapsed, so we don't have to worry about them anymore. And then the English came, but the Japanese didn't like the English.
While the English didn't push religion, the Japanese didn't necessarily trust them. They felt that the English were kind of skeevy.
So in the end, by the 1640s, the only nations that were allowed to trade with Japan were the Chinese and the Dutch.
Because the Dutch, being Protestants, did not try to proselytize.
And then, they created their own version of the Chinese Canton system. Basically outlawing anyone to land in any of the ports other than Tsushima, on the southernmost tip, as far away from the capital as possible. If a Westerner was caught anywhere in Japan, they would be killed on sight.
And then finally, just like the Chinese did, they began completely regulating all trade.
The shogunate determined what could be exported, what could be imported.
Because the goal was lockdown.
Questions? But I got one last thing to share.
And I'm going to end it kind of like I did in the Japanese. The Chinese, because we will come back.
While the Tokugawa would establish absolute control
over all life in Japan, there was one tiny flaw. And the flaw was opened up in the late 1700s.
When the Dutch proved to be dependable trading partners, meaning they didn't try to go around the Tsushima system, they played by the rules, the Tokugawa would allow the Dutch to leave some books behind. Because by the 18th century, Europe is going through the scientific revolution. And there would be some in Japan that would look for better information, knowledge, than they had. This would give rise to a movement. It's not an actual school, but it's a movement called the School of National Learning. As we're going to see, it would be these thinkers that began debating, basically, what is the meaning to be Japanese? That the Tokugawa shogunate would solely begin to erode. Because as we're going to see, a lot of the values of the shogunate system is based on Confucianism, which is a Chinese idea. So some of the Japanese said, we want to get rid of the Chinese, because the Chinese are getting their butts kicked by the Europeans. So maybe let's get rid of the Chinese, and maybe we can embrace some of the European ideas.
So Dutch books on science, Dutch books on engineering, Dutch books on military tactics, they would be allowed to come in.
Questions? We're in Asia. Let's go back to the Middle East.
We'll talk about the first of the three gunpowder kingdoms.
The Ottoman Empire.
You know, before I forget, some people can't read. I want to make sure they're here.
You're Deshaun, right?
Kira. I'm Deshaun.
You are. You were sick. That's why you kind of look like death.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to say anything, though.
Thanks.
You feeling better?
Not really.
Oh, well, at least you're here. Better to be 6 foot up than, you know, laid out in your bed. All right, you are?
Deshaun.
What did I do? That one, four down two. Anyone else come in late?
Trey came in.
Emergence of the Europeans on a global level. The Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans were not native to the Middle East, but rather the Ottomans were a Turkish people who came from somewhere in Asia. Believed to be in and around the same area that the Huns came from and the Mongols came from. And at some point in around the 700s, they came from Asia and made their way all the way down into modern Turkey, where they would take root.
So, they came from, again, it's believed to be somewhere like here. And then they slowly migrated their way across and ended up here. Now, initially, the Turks were polytheistic. They worshipped nature gods, including the same high god of the Mongolians, Tengri, the sky god.
But as they made their way through, they became exposed to some of the world's other religions. Some of them converted to Christianity. Others converted to Buddhism or some other minor religions like Zoroastrianism or something like that. But the bulk of them, when they came into this part of the world, they arrived at the same time that Muhammad and his Muslim armies were blasting out of Arabia and conquering this part of the world. As they converted, they were able to take advantage of a loophole in the Islamic faith. Islam allows for slavery. It is perfectly fine. It is not regarded as immoral or sinful. But the catch is, only non-Muslims can be enslaved. So, chances are, these Turkish people were sick and tired of being slaves, so they converted to Islam, so they could get their freedom. But when they did, they had no land, they had no opportunity, so they ended up serving as warriors. And they broke into clans. One clan, called the Seljuks,
would actually rise up and would overthrow the ruling dynasty. By the way, it was the Seljuk Turks who triggered the Crusades.
Seljuks, I knew it was going to come up as a click.
They would control the Middle East. They would put themselves up in a ruling system called a caliphate. But they forced the spread of the Turkish language, not Arabic, which is common in most Islamic countries.
But they are also responsible for causing many of the Christians that were there also to convert to Islam to avoid enslavement.
But even though the Seljuks were successful, because the Muslims ended up winning the Crusades, they were dealt a curveball when the Mongolians invaded. When the third son of Genghis, Ogedai, would send the horde into the Middle East.
While they did not conquer the Middle East, they would destabilize things, causing the Seljuks to fall. And it was when the Seljuks fell that created a vacuum for the other significant band of Turks,
the Ottomans, to rise. So, they started out as a lesser people. But when the best Turks were defeated, that allowed them to take control. And that's essentially what they would do. All right. The name Ottoman comes from one of the early leaders, Osman. And it would be Osman that would set his people on the path to eventual conquest.
Now, Osman was originally a tribal leader. He was kind of like a chief. And he,
as chief, did all those chief things. He ruled over his tribe of people. He protected them. And he engaged in conflict with his neighboring clans, if you will. But at some point,
Osman had a dream. And in his dream, he believed that Allah spoke to him and would give him a mission. Allah told him, conquer all who stand in your way and spread Islam. And that would be the mission of the Ottoman Empire. Conquest, spreading the faith.
During his lifetime, he went from controlling one village, which had two parts to it, to carving out a little niche of subduing some of his neighboring tribes. Now, not all was done with conquest. Some was done through alliances. But at the end, he began building an empire where he controlled other groups. His dream was carried on by his son and successor, Orhan.
Orhan was Osman's second son, but succeeded him as being Bey, the high chief.
During his reign, his armies, for the first time, went to war with the Byzantine Empire.
The remnants of the Eastern Roman Empire.
and carved out a good chunk of northwestern Turkey. He conquered and he spread the faith. But he deviated from his father. Because according to Osman, any Muslim was a Muslim. But according to Orhan, only those who believed the Quran as he did were Muslims. So what I'm suggesting is that he would do something that technically was forbidden by Muhammad. Muslims should not fight other Muslims. But Orhan would basically say, well, if you don't believe my Islam, you're not a Muslim. He also would be the first man to claim for himself the title of Sultan. Sultan is kind of like an emperor. So he saw himself as having the highest authority over all of the region. And he would devote his reign to following his father's dream, conquest, spreading the faith. But when you're conquering, you can't govern. So Orhan is also credited with creating another aspect of the Ottoman system of government. He tasked his brother, Alaaddin, to be vizier. A vizier is something similar to like a chancellor or a prime minister.
While Orhan was leading armies into battle, Alaaddin stayed in the capital and ran the state. Made sure taxes were paid, made sure food was collected, etc.
And this ruling system, Sultan Vizier, would be in place all the way until the Ottoman Empire fell.
But there was a problem. Because if you're going to go to war with other Turks, how are you going to get even other bands of Turks to join you fighting against the Turks that you believe are not following the faith right?
Oh, Orhan and Alaaddin would also come up with a special group of warriors
who would swear an oath to the Sultan directly.
And these special divisions who would be tasked with aiding the Sultan in conquering and spreading the faith were called Janissaries.
These would primarily be foot soldiers, infantry, but they were the shock troops. They were the most loyal, they were the most devoted,
and you could almost claim the most fanatical.
Their job was to do the bidding of the Sultan.
But who were they? Why were they so fanatical? Well, the soldiers and the Janissaries were literally taken from their parents using a system called the Devshrim,
the blood tax. Christians, because by the way, the majority of the population in the Middle East at this time was still Christian.
In order for a village to retain Christianity, they had to give up their boys. Anywhere between 8 and 18.
They would be taken from their families, taken from their village, brought back to the capital.
And not only trained how to fight, but they would be converted to Islam. Now, if you know anything about religion, the people who have the strongest faith are the people who, as adults, choose their religion, as opposed to those who were raised in a religion by their parents. Because you made that decision. Well, these boys were taken from their family's religion and given the choice. Convert, join the army, and you will basically live like princes. They would serve upwards of 20 years. And then when they were done, they would be sent home. And this was brilliant. Because one of the first things the Janissaries did when they retired was to go and get a wife. Now here's the catch. In Christianity, typically, the religion of the children is the religion of the mother. But in Islam, it's the religion of the father. So, the retired Janissary would get a Christian girl. She would have to convert to Islam. And then suddenly their kids are Muslims. Which basically means it's only a matter of a few generations where you cut off the links to Christianity. And you are left with just a Muslim population.
Orhan was tremendously successful.
But it was during the reign of his fifth son, Murad, when the Ottomans would become an intercontinental power. During his reign, his forces sailed across the Dardanelles and would seize control. Would seize control of this little peninsula down there called Gallipoli. And from that, they would begin marching north, conquering, that's Greece, that's Macedonia. And in doing so, surrounding little Constantinople, which was once the seat of the Eastern Roman Empire. But what made Murad's reign unique was that he didn't do it through warfare. He did this through diplomacy.
Now, granted, his diplomacy was kind of like the mafia or a neighborhood group of gangbangers. When they would show up to like a little store and basically offer the store owner their protection. You know, because it would be a really tragic thing if suddenly like your glass window on your storefront would be blown out. And it would be a really bad thing if your inventory was slowly taken out of your store. Or your building accidentally caught on fire. But if you know, if you pay a little bit, you'll be fine.
So he basically began telling the princes, the Bulgarian princes, the Serbian princes, look, if you pay me and send me soldiers when I call, I will not conquer your lands. And if you'll notice, all of the pink are his vassals. Which actually included Constantinople.
Not that you need to remember this at all. I don't even know if your book talks about it. But there would be actually a coup that took place in Constantinople where the rightful emperor was deposed and murdered. And then the person who did that took the throne for himself. But Murad would actually help the rightful emperor's son, John V, who was only 8 years old, basically retake the throne. In exchange for that quid pro quo, we'll put you back on power, but your throne is basically mine. But the Ottomans would use the tribute system, which in part is how their empires, we're going to see next class, would be huge, one of the largest empires ever. But the last rule that I'm going to touch upon is Bazayed. Bazayed was Murad's, I think, third or fourth son, but he was chosen to be the heir. Now, Bazayed's reign is brief, but he would reverse the decision of his father. Instead of using diplomacy, he would conquer. But he would attempt to return to Osman's dream. Osman's dream was that he was supposed to conquer and spread Islam. Well, Bazayed realized the best way to inspire the men is to issue fatwas. A fatwa is like a decree that comes from a king, or a papal bull that comes from the pope. Essentially, it's a call for war by Islamic scholars. These calls for war essentially could justify anything, essentially making every war a holy war, which if you're devoted, that means you are literally defending your faith. Now, the amazing thing about Bazayed is he used fatwas against Christians and Muslims. And to make sure he got victory, he used his Christian soldiers and had them attack the Muslims. But he used his Muslim soldiers to attack the Christians. So he took advantage of the political dynamic that existed in the Middle East. He also was the first ruler ever in human history to build a standing army. Throughout history, armies were raised only during wartime. And typically they were like militias. So a call would go out and guys would have to, you know, pick up whatever weapons they had and go march off to war. But then the moment the war was off, they went back to their farms. Well, Bazayed would raise an army of about 200,000 men. And they would get paid to spend their off time training until war was declared. First army of professional soldiers. He also was the first war leader to use a new technology that was developed in Europe, thanks to the Mongolians and the Silk Road. Gunpowder came across. And by the 14th century, the first primitive cannons were built. They were called bombards. They were like mortars. Fill the cup with gunpowder, and you put a rock in it about the size, I don't know, of a large suitcase, and you fire it, and it hurtles the rock, going at subsonic speed, and you can blast it up against walls. Because prior to the development of bombards, the only way to take a city was to lay siege. And that took time. That took effort. That took life. Amen. We'll see what he did when he come back. I'm not going to go late. So when we come back on Thursday, we're going to finish up with Bazayed, and we're going to see how he almost lost all of the Ottoman Empire. And then we're going to see what happened when his great-great-grandson emerges and conquers everything. Now, on a side note, your exams are done, but there are a couple of people that did not take it. So until they contact me and ask for makeup, I'm not going to unleash the exams or open up the exams. Okay? All right. We'll see you later. Stay warm.